I'd like to call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday, March 15th. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones. Today, as a courtesy, members present are Senator Geisel, Senator Begich, Senator Machicki, Senator Von Imhoff, and myself, Senator Wilson. At this time, we would like to invite Mr. Christopher Cook to the microphone. Mr. Cook has been nominated by the governor to the Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees. He is here today to introduce himself and to answer any questions from the committee. Mr. Cook, we'd just like to state your name and your affiliation for the record, and please just give an overview of yourself.
Thank you very much, Senator Wilson, and good afternoon. First of all, my name is Christopher Cook, and I appreciate the committee having this hearing at this late hour, and I'm delighted to be here, to be able to be here in person to discuss my appointment to the Mental Health Trust Authority Board, which, of course, is subject to legislative confirmation. I'm an attorney. I'm a 49-year Alaskan. I'm a father of three children. I'm a grandfather of nine, all of whom live in Alaska. And I've lived in, throughout Alaska, I've lived in Kotzebue, Nome, and for over 25 years in Bethel, and now reside in Anchorage. Most of my professional career has been, a variety of things. First as a legal services attorney in Anchorage and Bethel, and then as in private practice. Served as Superior Court Judge in Bethel for 10 years from 1976 to 86, and returned to private practice, and have had a practice both in Bethel and in Anchorage during that period of time, and in the last couple of years have retired from practice in a gradual way. I wrapped up cases I had, stopped taking new cases, and eventually stopped paying rent, so at that point I was done. But I'm still interested in a lot of issues that confront Alaskans, and became involved and educated myself about the Mental Health Trust Authority over the last several years. Had some contact with the board and some of the programs of the trust, and I feel like this would be a place where I would like to participate and commit to serving Alaska, and I appreciate the opportunity to come before you, and would be happy to answer any questions you may have. I'm also pleased, I forgot to mention this morning, I'm also pleased that several board members of the trust are here just as an expression of support, Lorraine Durr and Larry Noreen. And Carlton Smith of Juneau was also at the hearing this morning. So I know all the members of the board. I haven't yet met Mr. Selby from Kodiak, but all the others I've met, and I'm looking forward to working with this fine group of people and advancing the mission and programs of the Trust Authority.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Are there questions from committee members?
We saw Mr. Cook this morning. Mr. Chair, thank you. So, Mr. Cook, I meant to actually pull up the article, but I'll try to do this from memory. The Mental Health Trust Authority, I believe, is taking steps to take over management of their investments for the board, for the trust. What is your view on that?
Well, I know by statute the financial assets of the trust are invested through the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and I'm not aware of any effort to change that circumstance. I think there were some recent articles about the land office, the trust land office, and the use of proceeds from land investments and reinvestment of that money by the trust. That can be a complicated issue. I'm not familiar with all the background that what the decisions were and what went into those decisions. I've read through some of the applicable statutes, which do seem to have, I mean, they're almost 25 years old now, and they do seem to have some ambiguities and some questions about whether they really fit the present-day situation. And as I understand it from talking with staff and people on the board, there will be some proposals to try to update the statutes and make it clear what the Trust Land Office is authorized to do or what the limits of that authorization are. So I expect that's going to be an ongoing issue, but I think a lot of good people are working on it, and obviously what I hope will happen, you know, my effort will be to see that, first of all, that it doesn't benefit the beneficiaries of the trust to have a lot of controversy and perhaps confusion and disagreements about how the trust operates and what the trust does with its assets, because the purpose of having these assets is to promote the interests of the beneficiaries. That's the goal. You know, it's not to own property. It's not to, just sort of engage in property development for development's sake. It's for the purpose of providing funds to promote programs that help the beneficiaries of the trust, which are also defined by statute. So that's that would be my priority in dealing with those kinds of issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So those lands that the trust owns have significant resources on them in many cases. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we would like to see those resources developed for the maximum benefit of Alaskans, but the Mental Health Trust benefits as well. So what is your position on resource development on Mental Health Trust lands?
The reason, I think, you know, obviously I'm not fully informed on the entire history of the trust, but as I understand it, the reason that the trust selected and was able to select lands with high mineral potential and other development potential was, like we talked about, to provide resources to benefit the beneficiary community. You know, instead of just owning mountains and glaciers, I believe the intent was to have those lands become productive, and from some of the meetings I've attended, I know there are lots of interests involved, including people who don't want to see development or people who you know, are concerned about the environmental impact or the wildlife and recreation values that those lands may contain. And those things are important, and it's important for the trust to work with anybody affected by a trust development, whether it's fishermen or environmentalists or local governments, other user groups. But that's not the primary purpose of the trust's ownership. The purpose is to benefit those folks that are the named beneficiaries of the trust. And while I think various – I'm getting long-winded here. While I think those interests are important and should be considered in the wider community, I still think the primary focus has to be on what will benefit the client groups that is a constituency of the trust. So I'm not opposed to development that produces revenue to – fund programs and efforts to improve the lives of the trust beneficiaries. But sometimes all these goals can be accomplished in innovative ways. For example, the trust has the ability to exchange land. You know, if a particular community, I understand there's a current question under consideration about possible development in the Ketchikan area. You know, that the trust can make a land trade, which will help the community realize or protect its interests while also obtaining other land that the trust can use for similar development to what might occur on trust land near Ketchikan. I hope that's responsive.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Yes, please.
And certainly land exchanges are a great way to benefit the mental health beneficiaries. My question is more specifically your position on resource mineral resource development on mental health trust land. Could you specifically articulate your position on that?
Well, I'm new to the board, and I don't know that I have a position on any specific development. I'm not opposed to mineral development. It's a matter of personal belief or philosophy. I would rely a great deal on what the land, the trust land office recommends, you know, what the costs and developments are. You know, I've been around long enough to remember and admire Jay Hammond, who always was pro-development, but he said, you know, we need to know what the costs as well as the benefits are, and, you know, consider the full picture before we just go ahead with something. We don't want to have development just for development's sake if it's going to cause harm to other things that we value. So I agree with that way of thinking, but again, the trust land is special land. It's not the trust is not charged with promoting other values beyond development, like preservation and conservation, just for the sake of keeping the land in a natural state. I don't know. I'd have to see a specific proposal, but I would try to bring a pragmatic approach to those kinds of issues, and not a philosophical one of lock it up and never develop anything. That's not my point of view.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We'll go to Senator Machicki and Senator Bagage.
So I that this is an important question.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain little coal mine, and I'm not going to tell you how I feel about it, but there's a little coal mine on trust land on the west side of Cook Inlet that is heavily opposed by environmental groups. Well, unfortunately, the trust has selected their lands for beneficiaries, right? And you don't get to move that enormous quantity of coal. I'm not asking you whether or not you're for coal mining. I'm just asking if it's for the benefit of those you serve. How are you going to respond to that pressure when the professionals at the trust and say, we plan to develop this particular resource, you will be there will be a lot of pressure on you from folks that don't believe that particular resource should be developed. How do you respond? How do you handle that sort of thing?
That's the Chewitna, I believe the name is, the project, and I'm not sure what the status of it is right now, but I did attend some of the trust authority board meetings where that was discussed, and there were folks that came in opposition to the proposed development. But again, I would tend to rely more on what the land office has proposed and submitted to the trust. I feel they're very competent, and I would trust their recommendations. You know, if there are legal issues from an environmental standpoint or whatever, the place to litigate those is not with the Trust Authority Board. It's with the court or wherever else they would intend to go. But you know, I mean, environmental, being concerned about the well-being of our environment is extremely important, but that's not the Trust's primary job.
Two more quick questions?
Yes.
Could you, why do you believe that your appointment was not successful in the 2015 session?
Well, part of it was I think I did not pay as much attention to the legislative confirmation process as in hindsight I should have. I attended the committee hearings like this by phone and not in person, and I you know, vowed that if the governor chose to select me this time, that I would take the time and make the effort to be here in person, reach out and talk to more legislators about their view of the trust and what issues they consider to be important. And I've been doing that by written communications and by personal contact with a number of legislators on other trips that I've had to Juneau and when I see them in constituent meetings in Anchorage. I don't know all the reasons, of course, for the vote the last time, but I think I was naive in not considering the important role the legislature has to play in the selection process, and older and wiser.
So, final question.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It wouldn't matter which party you used to be the chair of. If you were the chair of one of the other parties, I would ask you the same question. This seat is should be very non-political.
Absolutely.
You at one point held one of the most political seats in the state. Is that is there any potential for that in the to get in the way of the very best decision-making processes that could occur for beneficiaries?
I can safely say that it will not. I understand this is a completely nonpartisan position. I view it that way. In fact, I don't know what political party the other members of the board belong to, and that's not my focus. It's true I was chair of the Democratic Party for 2 years, from 1998 to 2000, I have not held party office since then. I'm not involved in local district committees or anything like that. You know, sometimes I vote for Democrats, sometimes I vote for Republicans, sometimes I vote for independents. And so the party label means nothing to me as far as the work of the trust authority is concerned.
Thank you.
Senator Begich.
Just based on the earlier question, Chris, and thank you for meeting with me late last month, mm-hmm. but it's safe to say that if the land office said there was a cost benefit, you know, that a mineral development had a net benefit to the beneficiaries, you'd support it. If the land office said that there was a net benefit to a mineral development to the
that's at least the threshold.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's the starting point. I just want to make that clear because there were a couple of questions around that. And I have two other questions, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue.
I was involved in the 87, 88, and 89 sessions, 87, 88 in particular, with when I worked for Representative Gruenberg in some of the manufacturing of the trust, the mental health trust settlement. And in the process, part of that impetus was to ensure that trust funds were invested wisely and invested in the permanent fund so that they would accrue over time to the beneficiaries. I have recently discovered that since 2009, there have been no deposits into the permanent fund of trust money. And money's basically been used out of the income account for some of the development. I know we have legislation now to kind of correct that and codify that. Would it be your intent to make to once again begin making deposits of trust income from its lands into the permanent fund?
You know, I'm not well informed on the financial history of the trust in terms of both the whether or not deposits have been made into the permanent fund, or if not, why not, or whether there were funds available after expenditures to do that. You know, I know that though over the past almost 25 years, the $200 million settlement amount with the permanent fund has grown to over $600 million, and the trust conducts its programs and administration of the trust based on the income that's derived from that investment without touching the principal. So, I know that the issue about the revenue from trust land is a current subject of interest to lots of folks, and and it's being addressed in a variety of ways, both perhaps with legislation. There's also legislative audit that will occur, but I'm really lacking sufficient knowledge to respond in a substantive way to your concerns about or your question about the reinvestment of trust funds in the permanent fund.
Follow up?
Yes, Senator Baggage.
To reassure you, Chris, I'm confident that you'll get up to speed on the issue, and I would encourage you just to take the time to look at the investment strategies as one of the members of the trust authority and ensure, as you've already averred that you will do, that the trust's assets be used, obviously, in the best interest of the beneficiaries. But that just and that brings me to just my last question. And you were asked a question about your past political affiliation, and of course that was with my party. So I kind of tongue-in-cheek want to ask you if your support of an independent or those other Republicans will also affect your judgment in any way. That's a trick question. I'm just joking with you.
No.
I'm just kidding. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions from this committee? Thank you, Mr. At this time, we'll open public testimony. Is there anyone online? Anyone online? Is anyone in the room like to testify on this confirmation of Mr. Cook? Hearing none, we'll close public testimony at this time. I'll entertain a motion to advance the appointee committee report from committee.
I move the following appointment to be forwarded to a joint session for consideration: Mr. Christopher Cook of Anchorage to the Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions.
Anyone object? Hearing no objection, we'll take an at ease to sign papers. And thank you, Mr. Cook, for coming. Hopefully you can make your flight.
Thank you, Senator Wilson.
back on record. Next, we're bringing back Senate Bill 91 to extend the disaster emergency opioid epidemic, which is sponsored by Senate Rules on behalf of the governor. We heard an overview and took public testimony on this bill on March 13th. Before you is Work Draft 30-GS1127-Delta. And do I hear a motion to entertain a motion to move this?
Are we
going to
move
draft?
It or are we going to go through the sectional? We have to move it first. Okay. All right. Sorry.
I move to adopt Work Draft 30-GS1127-D as in Delta as the committee substitute.
I object for purposes of explanation of changes.
Yes. Thank you. So to give a quick overview, before you guys have a sectional, and we'll quickly go over this sectional here. Section 1 authorizes the chief medical officer to issue a standing order, including a statewide standing order for the prescription of the opioid overdose drug. Section 2 repeals Section 1 on June 30th, 2021. Section 3 extends to February 14th of 2018 of the opioid epidemic and the public health disaster emergency declared by Governor Walker on February 14th, 2017. This section also limits the sources of funding that the governor may use to respond to the disaster emergency and requires the Department of Health and Social Services to complete a report and to submit that report to this legislator on or before October 1st of 2018, describing the activities and expenditures related to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration grants and the disaster emergency. Section 4 makes the bill retroactive to March 15th, 2017. And Section 5 provides an immediate effective date for the bill. So, the intent of the CS, again, was basically to just make sure that we're limiting the scope of the funding to the federal SAMHSA funds, which the state of Alaska is already receive, with a declaration and the distribution of naloxone. The other part of this is that it would allow the state legislature, if deemed, to also allow additional funds to be expended for this if additional federal grants or other funding sources were allowed during the responding to the disaster emergency. And the last part of that was to make sure that we don't limit, in limiting the funding to for the opioid or substance abuse treatment for the disaster, that current projects won't be hit and won't be affected by the actions of this Senate Bill 91.
So I have a quick comment.
Yes, Senator Vandermoff.
I just want to say thank you to our chair for working on this CS. I actually really appreciate the changes that you've done to this, and I support them. And I feel that you've responded to some of our concerns that we brought up on Monday, and thank you for doing that.
Okay. And this also allows the state medical director to have that five-year coverage as well to make sure that that coverage is offered to extend the naloxone throughout the community of Alaska under his guidance and supervision. Senator Baggage.
I too, Mr. Chair, wanted to thank you for making the changes and also wanted to acknowledge that I understand this is acceptable, as is to the department as well. So I'm all for it.
I do believe there is one little correction that we would like to make.
Mr. Sherman, I offer a conceptual amendment. Do you want me to remove my objection first to the CS that you've offered?
Before you do, I do also have Kate Glover on Ledge Legal on the phone if anyone had any questions about the CS.
Before you...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Machicki.
Do we have evidence from the department that they are okay with this other than anecdotal? For someone to share that on the record, that's sort of atypical.
Dr. Butler, if you'd like to.
Uh,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer of the Department of Health and Social Services. And, yes, we are in support of the amended bill, the CS.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for announcing.
I just have one question on the CS before, perhaps, before you move your objection. Was there was extending the I should have maybe asked this question when Dr. Butler was up here, but was extending the was the overlap important on the emergency declaration, considering we're providing the authority for a standing order?
I'm not sure if I understood the overlap in.
So we extended the emergency order until 2018, right?
Yes.
However, we immediately authorize on March 15th of 2017 the chief medical officer to issue a standing order, which I thought was the reason for the declaration in the first place.
I thought it was only good for 30 days, and so this is sort of doing a like a 1-2 type of step.
So, and maybe Kate Glover, alleged legal, could answer that question. Ms. Glover, are you available?
Through the chair, this is Kate Glover with alleged legal. Am I online? Are you able to hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
I can restate the question.
Ms. Glover, we can have Senator Maticky to restate the question.
Yes, good afternoon. We extended to February 14th of 2018 the opioid epidemic public health disaster emergency declared by Governor Walker. Yet I thought the reason for the declaration was to essentially authorize the chief medical officer to issue a standing order. So if the standing order is effective March 15th of 2017, why do we need the overlap on the emergency declaration?
Senator Maticky, through the chair, this is Kate Glover with Legal Services. As I understand, the purpose of the extension is to extend the declaration of a disaster emergency because the governor only has authority to declare a disaster emergency for 30 days. So this bill would extend that for an additional year. The first section of the bill also authorizes the chief medical officer to issue a standing order, and that can be effective through the June 30th of 2021. But I think that the purpose of the retroactivity provision to March 15th is so that there's no gap between the expiration of the governor's disaster declaration and the extension.
Follow-up, Senator?
I think we have a disconnect. The reason for the declaration was to not have a need for the standing order, yet we're providing a standing order and no longer have a reason for the emergency declaration. And we're extending the emergency declaration, although we're providing a standing order that begins on March 15, 2017, and goes to 21.
Senator Maticky, through the chair, the March 15, 2017 applies to the entire bill, not just to the standing order. As to the purpose for the standing order, that may be for the specific authorization for the standing order, that may be a question more appropriately directed to the department. If that's the sole purpose of extending the disaster emergency, then that would be a question for the department.
Senator Maticky, and I don't want to speak for the department, but I believe that the life of the grant is a five-year grant, and so by extending the orders for the chief medical officer, it extends for the lifetime of the project declared under the disaster.
Mr. Chairman, respectfully, that's quite clear to me. I don't believe we any longer have a reason for an emergency declaration, which is my primary question. And we've extended that a year, although we have retroactive coverage for the standing order, which was the reason for the emergency declaration. So I don't believe that we need both, but I would love to hear from the department if that's, I mean, I think there are exposures to an emergency declaration, and that's the reason we kind of jumped to make sure this occurred. It seems like we're sort of double authorizing the activity, if you will.
If, Dr. J. Butler, would like to come back to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jay Butler again, for the record. I mean, Senator Machicki, I think through the chair, I think what you're describing is correct. The disaster declaration was intended to establish the authority of the chief medical officer to do the prescription, and the bill now actually establishes that authority and extends it through the life of the funding cycle for the program. So the whether or not we need the disaster declaration once we have that authority, I think, is a valid question. I was appreciating the double endorsement myself, but if it's unnecessary, I'll defer to the legal counsel on that. Thank you.
Go to Senator Giesel and Senator Baggage.
So, Dr. Butler. The emergency order also allowed federal receipts of funding. Is that correct?
No, Senator Giesel, through the chair. The funding had already been acquired through the federal grant. So we were pursuing the grant and looking for ways to be able to, first of all, determining did we need to have a standing order, but the sequence events played out such that having the disaster declaration was the most expeditious way to move forward with the program.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So, if we were to delete this extension of the emergency order, it would not implicate or remove any of the funding. It is secure.
Senator Giesel, through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
Senator Baggage.
My question was answered by Senator Giesel.
Yeah. And I just have one question that either maybe Ms. Glover can answer, Dr. Butler. Through the extension of this declaration, is the department or the administration looking to acquire more federal funds throughout different departments? I know you probably speak to the Department of Health and Social Services. That was my understanding that they were also looking for other ways for corrections, public safety, and has to continue to acquire other federal funds through this declaration, or is this the only current project?
Mr. Chairman, we are looking for other federal sources of funds. We, you know, like everyone is aware, general funds are not available, so our assumption is that whatever we can do needs to be done with funds that we can acquire from elsewhere.
Do we need a declaration for that?
No, sir. We did not.
Thank you, Dr. Butler. Take a brief at ease.
We're back on record. Do we have removal of the objection?
Mr. Chairman, I remove my objection.
Thank you. Do we have any other amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I wish to offer a conceptual amendment and ask Ms. Glover if this works. So there are two facets to my conceptual amendment. The most simple one and first one is on line 5, letter D, delta, starts out, the chief medical officer may issue. So there's a lot of chief medical officers out there, Mr. Chairman, and so I believe the specification should be made the chief medical officer of the Department of Health and Social Services may issue a standing order. So that's the first part of conceptual amendment. The second part relates to Section 3, letter A, alpha, and that appears on line 11 on page 1. And we have identified that A is not needed, that is to say the extension of the disaster emergency, because we are authorizing on line 5 the chief medical officer of DHSS to issue the standing order. So that authorization is being taken care of in line 5. We don't need a disaster extension to do that. So we believe that removing Section A and then going on to page 2 and removing references to that extension on lines 3, 5, and 14 would retain the restrictions on the money aspect of all of this, but remove that reference to the extension. There's also the word extending in line 1, page 1 in the title, but that's a drafter's expertise there. So that is my conceptual amendment, Mr. Chairman. The addition of DHSS to the chief medical officer specification and the removal of the extension of the disaster emergency.
Thank you, Senator DeGiesel. Ms. Glover, were there any concerns?
Senator Giesel, through the chair, I don't have any concerns about that. Well, I guess let me say a little bit more. And with respect to the first part, adding Department of Health and Social Services after Chief Medical Officer, I think that would be fine. I believe, although I can't give you a citation right now, I believe we do use the term Chief Medical Officer elsewhere in the statute to refer to the Chief Medical Officer of Department of Health and Social Services without specifying that, but I don't believe it would hurt to clarify that here. With respect to the second part, if we were to remove A, I don't believe that we need B. The only reason that the governor has the authority to transfer funds from other sources to use the disaster relief fund is because there has been because he's declared a disaster emergency. I believe that disaster emergency ends today. Today's the 15th. And so once that disaster emergency expires, then there's no longer a need for those specific funding restrictions under B. If you still want to report, then C is helpful. But I don't believe that B would be necessary anymore either if the only intent of extending the disaster was to allow for standing orders, then all that needs to happen is to allow standing orders. But the authority to spend funding that is not appropriated for this purpose goes away when the disaster declaration ends.
Thank you, Ms. Glover. Any questions for Ms. Glover?
I have one question.
Senator Michiki?
We plan to, in support of the opioid epidemic activities, we plan to have this on the Senate floor in the morning. Are there any complications to having us a bill that has the conceptual amendment that Senator Giesel discussed with you to us by 11 a.m. or prior to 11 a.m.?
Senator Michiki, through the chair, I can't speak for how quickly we can get things through the office, but we can try our best.
Take a brief at ease, Ms. Glover. Back on the record. Senator DeGiesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Glover, during our ad ease, we took under consideration your recommendation to remove Section B, Bravo, on page 2 and saw the wisdom of that. C now becomes the only piece of Section 3, but we would like to make sure those are annual reports. So what is C? Line 12 on page 2 deletes on or before October 1, 2018. The sentence begins, the Department of Health and Social Services shall annually, the word annually is added, complete a report describing activities and expenditures, etc.
Senator Giesel, through the chair, that sounds fine. Would those be annual reports through June 30th, 2021, the same as the date Section 1 is repealed?
Well, actually, our thought was that it's possible that the governor may or the department may secure an additional grant that even goes beyond 2021, in which case we would want to continue to get annual reports.
Senator Giesel, through the chair. Okay, that sounds fine. So the reporting requirement would continue in effect indefinitely. The standing order would be repealed on June 30th, 2021, what remains of the act would take effect immediately.
That is the amendment, the conceptual amendment. Yes. Thank you.
Senator Giesel, through the chair, I think I understand that. I think we'd also probably want to make some changes to the title if that would be okay with the committee.
Yes, we anticipated that too. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I could reiterate the conceptual amendment.
Yes, please.
So, Mr. Chairman, I move a conceptual amendment, number one, that being on page 1, line 5, after the words, the chief medical officer would be added to this phrase, of the Department of Health and Social Services. Then going down to section 3, line 11, removing subsection A, alpha, and continue on page 2, removal of subsection B, bravo. Then under subsection C, that's line 12 on page 2, Charlie, the sentence would delete on or before October 1, 2018, and would begin, the Department of Health and Social Services shall annually, the word annually would be added there, complete a report, continuing on. Then throughout, then in section C, there is a phrase on line 14 at the end of the line that says extended under this section that is no longer relevant and should be removed. That is the conceptual amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator DeGiesel. Is there any objection?
No objection, just and a conforming title change.
Yes, conforming title change. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Glover, can we also request explanation of the changes to accompany the CS as amended?
To the chair, yes, I can do that.
And thank you, Ms. Glover, for all your help and assistance in tonight with this with Senate Bill 91.
You're welcome.
No objection. That's the conceptual amendment passes. Is there objection to the Senate Bill?
This time I'd like to entertain.
Thinking at ease. Back on the record. Is there any other objection to Senate Bill 91, version 30GS, 1127-D as amended. Hearing none, this is moved from committee.
She hasn't made the motion.
Oh,
okay.
Sorry.
I would entertain a motion.
Is there a motion to move this?
I move Senate Bill SB 91, Health and Social Service, Version D, as amended, from committee with updated forthcoming fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? With that, we move this committee. We'll take an ad to sign the document. Record. Are there any members closing comments?
No.
As a reminder, we're back on Friday this week to hear Senate Bill 83, the governor's bill related to vulnerable adults. Thank you, everyone, for attending this late night session of Senate Health and Social Services Committee. We are adjourned at 6:30 p.m.